This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Well, I'm sure Elton John intended to be butch with that number, but not nearly as butch as Nickelback managed to make him sound. Fantastic. And you're here on Joy on Saturday Magazine. It's 22 and a bit minutes past 11, and it's time now to talk with our special guest for this morning's segment of Journeys, Chris Ada-Hillis. Good morning.
Good morning, Nick and Carol.
Now, you're no stranger to Joy because we've had you coming and going through the studios. Talking about books in your capacity as owner, running co-owner of Hares and Hyenas.
That's correct. Yeah, over many years now.
And I guess, look, I've been quite astounded at the your background in terms of the arts, because I just did not, and that's my fault because I obviously hadn't done my homework earlier, but I really hadn't realised just how much involvement you have had, particularly, you know, with the written arts as well.
That's right.
But even more broadly, I mean, is this something? It obviously must be something.
Well,
that
are you surprised
been...
by it yourself?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really surprised. Partly because I had a really very busy freelance career for a very long time. Mm. I sort of really went from my early 20s through to when I was just about, must have been in my early 40s, when I never had a full-time job apart from the bookshop. And I never worked full-time in the bookshop because I always had a very busy freelance career doing writing, publishing, event management, and a whole range of other things like that.
Now, is it right, you did some editing as well? You've done some editing
as
well?
I've done lots of editing. Yeah. I've edited books. Yeah. I've done heaps of editing from everything from sort of corporate to medical to forensic to lots and lots of literary. So just all over the place.
So let's go back another step. Your background, you know, for example, at school, I mean, did you, you must have been sort of arts rather than science boy.
I was a little bit sporty at different times because I had two older brothers who were very, very sporty. And I grew up in the time when you didn't have any choice but to do things like play cricket, play football. I like swimming and I like tennis a lot. And but in, you know, in year 11 and 12, I majored in 10-pin bowling because it was a choice.
It was the shoes, wasn't it?
And it also meant
those two coloured shoes really
right.
do it, yeah.
And you got to walk out of school and sort of be on complete trust for the next 3 hours, and every once in a while you just fake a bowling score and total back after spending the afternoon in the pub.
So when did you decide that you wanted to make a career of writing and the arts?
In fact, do you decide to do that?
Yeah, I fell into it, really. Mm. One of the early things was I'd been doing a lot of writing when I was a lot younger, sort of like through the time of the punk scene when Roland and I were involved in that in the early 80s. I first started writing stories and things things that were pretty much based on life, but also I think at that stage I was trying to be a little bit artier, so I could often you couldn't really... It wasn't very good writing, anyway. Mm.
But you got published nevertheless.
Oh, yeah, eventually. Yeah. And then it sort of fell into place in the sort of later in the 80s that just made a contact with a friend of mine who was a marketing manager at Melbourne Festival. And he discovered that, you know, I could translate French, but also I could write program notes. And out of that, I developed sort of quite a long-running, a 19-year relationship with Melbourne Festival. Mm-hmm. Firstly, as the writer of all their program notes, and then as the editor of all their publications.
Mm, which are considerable, yeah.
Yeah, it is considerable. And especially back then, there was a lot... The artistic directors at the time were really keen to sort of make the festival an incredibly sort of educational experience for the audiences. And so that involved working with writers from all over the world and commissioning them to write notes and things. And from then it just sort of took off, and my job just started getting bigger and bigger, and then they offered me a full-time job in marketing, which I had no experience in at all. And within a year of doing that, I became the marketing manager at Melbourne Festival, which I did for the next 2 to 3 years.
Did you enjoy that?
I enjoyed it immensely. It was incredibly pressured. I think the last year I was there was possibly the hardest because I was the first with the new director, Christy Edmonds, and it was a very different type of festival in terms of like what was coming in, and it was actually quite a... It was quite a challenge to really start shifting the way in which that festival had been marketed. It had started already under Robin Archer. I think the reason I got the job is because they realised that I had an interest in developing new audiences and to sort of change the demographic down from an older demographic to a much younger demographic. Mm. So there was a lot of freedom and a lot of opportunity to come up with a whole lot of new ideas. We'd started doing things like introducing free public program launches rather than just having everything invited and VIP.
Yep,
for them. We started doing sort of materials in other languages. I was in the position of being able to employ lots of people who had specialist knowledge in sort of reaching new audiences. So it was very challenging, and the budget went down at the same time, partly because I think we were spending far too much money on marketing at the festival, and so I was able to release quite a lot of the money back to sort of artists. So
that's good. And they were pretty queer old times too, in, when both Robin and Christy were at the helm, I think.
There has never been a straight director of the Melbourne International Arts Festival,
Good to hear, yes.
I'm interested that you went sort of from what is, you know, very much involved in arts on the sort of ground level, with a background in writing and arts and stuff, and he went to marketing. Now, admittedly, marketing for, obviously, an arts organisation, but it almost seems oxymoronic, you know, marketing arts, because it's like the two things just don't, in my mind, certainly, they don't go together. And I find it interesting that you obviously had some great ideas, which have probably come out of that sort of artistic background. But my personal experience is that a lot of people who get those great ideas are not very good often at being in the position of being in charge and making them work, putting them into action. So it's interesting that you were able to do that, and you've obviously enjoyed doing that.
Well, I think the experience of having been an editor for so long, I always saw my role as an editor is to bring out the very best in the work that's already there. And sometimes that means being quite harsh with a writer and really getting complete rewrites. Sometimes it's a matter of really just tweaking things, and sometimes it's about letting people... And sometimes it's actually just accepting, no, they're not going to do that, and I'm just going to have to make the best of it, and so I'm going to correct the grammar and do whatever else I can to make it all right. Mm. But if you take the sort of idea that as an editor, you're a facilitator of the best result. If you look at that in the same way in terms of marketing or arts administration, you actually remove your ego from the relationship quite strongly, and you actually start looking at the people, the work, and saying, how is the best way to represent this? Mm. Arts marketing is different from any other form of marketing, and I remember at one point, you know, saying to Robin Archer, this is a great job because I'm being paid to tell the truth about art. And in fact, I've been paid to find the audience for this show. Mm. I'm not being paid to find an audience for the festival. Mm-hmm. And the change that I think that sort of myself and the marketing manager before me, Warwick Tin, and sort of brought it to the festival was stopping looking for a festival audience, stopping looking for a sort of like a generic demographic that comes along and sees it, which is, you know, private school educated, over 40-year-old female, and in fact often over 50-year-old female.
And getting older,
And then looking at the shows and saying, who is the audience for this? And so breaking it down from being festival marketing to event marketing.
Yeah, so it's less going for the brand and actually going back to the content and who's really interested.
Yeah, and you get an opportunity to actually really try to explain exactly what the work is about, and it's very different than just trying to sell tickets. Mm.
In terms of brands, you've got Hares and Hyenas. How long have you been Hares and Hyenas, you and Roland?
About 18 and a half years now. Wow.
And how did that come to be? And tell us a bit about Roland. Roland's no stranger to joy and audiences.
No, Roland is a pretty amazing person who actually had the idea and the passion for Hares and Hyenas to start. We'd both been working in bookshops previously in the 80s, and he was at Hartwigs in Fitzroy, which had a big gay section, and he was managing that. We were just kept on thinking, if we ever got the money together, we'd like to start a bookshop, a queer bookshop. And we never believed that we'd ever get the chance to do it, because we just always expected someone in Melbourne to do it, or expected Sydney Bookshop Darlinghurst to come down and open one here. And it just turned out that with a single loan of $20,000 from Roland's mother, we were able to secure a shop in Commercial Road after looking in St Kilda as well. Fortunately, we didn't get the shop in Fitzroy Street, because I think Commercial Road was a much better place to start.
Yeah, well, it became the hub at that time, right. Really, didn't it? And was Hares and Hines was very much part of that too.
Yeah, and then we signed the lease on the 2nd of December 1991, and we opened the doors on the 23rd of December 1991, having worked sort of night and day with James Eden, who's a well-known figure around the place, who did all the architectural and building of the whole thing. And then it just sort of took off from there.
And stuff. And what about Roland? How long have you two been together?
Roland and I have been together since 1980, but we were best friends since 1975. In the first week that I started university at Melbourne University, I sort of met him at that stage. I thought he was a complete weirdo because he had huge afro hair and he hung around with all the druggies and weirdos in the place. But in fact, he didn't swear, he didn't take drugs, he was just a very, very person who was very, very connected to sort of like countercultural ideas and music and things.
With Nick and Carol, and this morning we're speaking with Crusader Hillis, who's the incoming new CEO of also.
I keep thinking of, MASH, you know, incoming CEO. Anyway, now, just before Crusader, you were talking about how you and Roland started up Hares and Hines, a bookshop, and how you go way back. Just how far back do you go?
Well, truth be told, our families have known each other for a couple of generations. They both come from South Gippsland. Roland's family was down around Foster Way, and my family were around Dumbork. And at that stage, there was a lot of socialising between the places. And Roland's dad, in fact, at one stage went out with my mother's cousin, and then she became a nun straight afterwards. Ah. But apparently his father was quite a gallant man who got around the dances quite a bit. My mother and his father knew each other very well through different circles as they were growing up. And when his family moved up to Numurkah, up past Shepparton, I think in the 50s, because I think Roland was born up there, and then our family moved up there in the early 60s. Mm. We moved in between Shepparton and Echuca, which was not a long way across. And we'd, in fact, had a couple of times where we visited each other during our childhood. But we did not recognise each other or had no idea who each other was when we first met again.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So when you met at uni...
Was it at uni?
Like we were living in a hall of residence at Melbourne University. He was doing a science and physics and meteorology and mathematics degrees, and I was doing an arts degree, although he was a lot artier than I was, I think, in so many ways, and had a lot more knowledge about it, and he'd been a playwright before that and everything.
Wow.
As you are when you're 19.
Yeah, well, no, he was doing that when he was 15 and 16, so he was pretty...
he was into it.
Yeah, he was very much into it. But when we did meet, it took about 2 or 3 months before we sort of put it all together.
So it was books at first sight and then everything followed on, wasn't it?
Well, not really, yeah. I mean, it was more theatre. Roland introduced me to the Pram Factory and to the Australian Performing Group and to La Mama and a whole range of other things. And his connection with culture and theatre was just so immediate, and he had so much knowledge about it at such a young age. And I was a complete and total Philistine on a certain level, because we didn't have any of that stuff at the school I went to in Shepparton. It was very basic. We had no art. We had no real things. I mean, you know, I was good at the sort of writing and everything else about it, but in fact I'd had no real experience of live shows apart from sort of going to things like Hair and Godspell, and in fact I got a chance to go and see the Netherlands Dance Theatre when I was about 14 or 15, because I had older sisters who were at university well before, so my only sort of cultural references sort of came from that. And
that's a fairly explosive one, a very new show probably at that age that these two throw on most.
Yeah, well, I guess great. You would have been at uni in the 70s then.
Yeah, 1975 I started.
Yeah. And that would have been a fabulous time for the arts in, well, in Australia. You know, Gough Whitlam put a lot of money into the arts just prior to that time. So,
and we lived in Drummond Street, so down the road was the Pram Factory, and there was so much going on all the time. So it was an incredibly interesting time. University was absolutely boring. It was still in the sort of Levisite sort of critical way of doing English, which I almost failed in my first year, even though it should have been my best subject.
I have a great fondness for LFR and Queenie Leavis, but we won't go into that here.
Yeah. But it was a very sort of static approach to and really I hardly did any work at university. I just passed.
it didn't encourage a creative response to what you're reading. So where did you do that? How did you get your creative stuff happening?
Through all the people you just hung around with. I mean, it was the first time I'd ever met people from private schools and things like that, and they sort of became friends. And then in my second and third year at university, I sort of developed really wide friendships with a whole lot of people from western suburbs and different countries and things. And it was a real eye-opener for me, I think, in many ways. The university courses itself were just, to me, they were pretty much, you just did them, passed them, moved on.
And got on with whatever was going there, So the question I really want to ask is, where does the name Crusader come from?
Well, a few years after this, in the like late 70s, Roland and I became really entrenched in the burgeoning punk scene in Melbourne, and there was probably at that stage only a few hundred people, and there was like the south side scene and the north side scene, and basically at that stage in 1979 and 1980 and 81, you could go out 7 nights a week in Melbourne and see different bands all over the place, and we did, and we ran a punk show on 3CR, which went from 12 to 6 every Monday night, and then got up and went to work the next day. It was just a time when I was experimenting with a whole lot of different names, because we were in a band called the Delicatessens, and for quite a while I was Amyl Nitrate, which was quite a fun name at the time. And Crusader Rabbit sort of stuck. There's two stories, and I'm not sure which one is the absolute truthful one. One is that I was at a party and I was accused of being a crusader because I was constantly attacking this mad American in tennis clothes as he was criticizing the fact that there was any such thing as women's tennis, because how can the women aren't athletes, so why would you bother putting them on TV?
I'm surprised you even mixed in circles with people like that. But anyway.
Oh, I was at a Lebanese friend's party, and her sister had a few strange conservative friends, and you know, you might as well just turn up to where you're invited, and they were next door neighbours, I think, at one point too. And the other story is that it just happened on stage one night. I took the name Crusader Rabbit. Whatever happens, it's sort of lost a little bit in history exactly how it happened. But
the name stuck.
By the beginning of 1980, I was Crusader Rabbit for quite a while, and then I just changed it just to Crusader Hillers, which is my original first name.
As you just said, we're speaking with Crusader Hillers, and you're listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9. We'll talk a little bit more about Crusader and perhaps a little bit about also very shortly. Nick and Carol.
And we're talking today with Crusader Hillers, who has a very Melbourne story, I have to say, Crusader, just thinking of all the connections and where you've been through the arts, through literature, through Hares and Hyenas, and through Gasworks, which we haven't really had time to mention, but Gasworks Theatre. And now you're moving on from Gasworks to becoming the CEO also. How's that transition for you?
Well, it's been good. It's been one that's been done on pretty much on my terms, which has been fantastic. When I took the job at Also earlier this year, I organised that it would be a 3-month transition from both organisations. So I've been doing part-time at Gasworks and at Also. So I started off just doing one day a month in March at Also, so I could just start getting my head around the place and not really have to take on too much administratively. The thing I've been doing mostly has been working on the awards, Also Awards, which are coming up on the 28th of June, which is a challenge, and it's also fabulous because it fits very much into my experience at Gasworks of sort of programming and running events and administering that organisation.
Arts marketing and things.
And the transition from Gasworks has been a really good thing, and having that length of time to be able to do that handover and get things to the point. I'm starting to get things done that I sort of had really aspired to do over the few years, but just really hadn't had the time to do it. And the pressure of leaving.
Just tell us a little bit about Gasworks, because it's a rather special place in Melbourne's art scene.
Yeah, look, I think interestingly it's starting to get recognised as Melbourne's pink art centre. Well, pink and lavender, and don't want to call it rainbow, but it's whatever.
Yeah.
It's because it's really one of its best audiences has been through the development of the Midsummer Festival, which then gets carried on right through. Last night we had Stand Up and Be Counted with five brilliant women comedians, and there wasn't a single one amongst them that didn't sort of really bring the house down in one way or another, from quite subtle to sort of very sort of provocative humour. And of that, there was about three or four lesbians as a part of that. And on Wednesday night, we had Funny Bono with four gay male comedians, Adam Richard, Scott Brennan, Toby Sullivan and Anthony Menchetti. So it was a really... Mm-hmm. So there's opportunities for us all year round to program queer stuff.
We certainly hear a lot about Gasworks Arts Park here on Joy. So there's obviously a lot of marketing towards the gay community as well, by the sound of things.
Oh, absolutely. I think our three major focus groups, apart from sort of bringing in hirers who bring in their own stuff, are kids, queer audiences and deaf and disability. Mm-hmm. And it's a really nice mix. And it's not a mix that's been particularly well exploited by other venues in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. So it actually gives us a real opportunity to differentiate ourselves and to develop very loyal audiences amongst that. And we mix those things up. I mean, we have kids' holiday programs in exhibition spaces during midsummer where there is not necessarily explicitly sexual, but obviously sort of homosocial art and things like this. And there has not been any real issues about it. We had a transgender conference a couple of years ago on a busy weekend with the cafe, and there was, 100 transgendered people from all across Australia mingling just with the cafe goers, and on that day we turned all the toilets into sort of non-gender specific toilets and all the rest of it. We didn't get a single complaint. There's an understanding in that area about live and let live.
And now you're heading for ALSO, which started out in life as the alternative lifestyle organisation, and now it just calls itself ALSO, but it's very much the same sort of milieu and connection in some ways.
Yeah, it is. I think it's very different in another way. It's going to be one of the things I think that I did best at Gasworks was relationship management from above and across. So I really brought City of Port Phillip back to the fold with Gasworks. I think they've really got an understanding now of why they fund it and why it's important.
Oh, good.
And I think I've been able to do that even with our local MPs and with a lot of other people around the place. And I think also is at that point where Lynn Morgane really brought in a lot of programs that have very much sort of shaped ALSO's aspirations in terms of wanting to do outreach and to start looking after marginalised groups and communities. And I think what I need to do now is start to sort of carry the messages from those out to the public and actually really start getting a bit of a pulse on what the queer community really want ALSO to do. And then to be able to actually explain what we do.
I was just thinking, from your marketing sort of hat, it's just too early to ask, what in a few years' time, what would you like people to say when they say, what's ALSO? What would you like the response to be?
I'd like them to say that ALSO is the place that can offer the opinions about what the queer community is feeling about it. And it's never going to be a single opinion. I'm not a single opinion person. In the same way as what I was talking about editing, it's a group effort, and so is anything to do with arts management and marketing. It all relies on sort of like group opinions about things and differences of opinions, and then about coming up with something that's agreeable. So it's not about compromise so much as about getting across that there's multiple points of view and that there's multiple different ways of experience. And you think about, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex and queer community or communities, what is it? There's so many differences and different needs across that. And to be a place which can be a sort of like a channeling house.
Mm. Also a lobby group, do you think, in that sense?
Definitely a lobby group, definitely an advocacy. Has to be involved in government. It needs to be involved. It's already on the ministerial committees for health and justice, and it needs to start getting much better relationships with things like DHS or Department of Health and a range of other areas as well. It's got to start being... It needs to be start being invited to offer opinions about what's needed.
Mm. Mm. Do you see the, your role at also as a more corporate sort of... Is also going to be a more corporate organisation than the places that you've worked before? I mean, I don't know whether that's the right term even, but... a little bit more sense of getting down to business?
To some extent, but at the same time, I'd like to see also go back in some ways to what it was in the mid-90s when you walked into that building and the place was thrumming with community groups using photocopiers and having meetings.
Mm.
And there was conversations that were happening between different organisations that just happened across a cup of coffee.
Because they were there, yeah.
And so for me, I want the downstairs from here, right underneath building here, to start being... I think it already is being used quite a bit by different organisations and there's some great connections there already. But I really want to put the offer out to community groups and all sorts of other people and as well that we actually... are there for you to be able to use some of the resources.
You want them to take a stake in also as well.
Yeah, I wanted it a bit noisy.
The gay community house, so to speak.
Yeah. Look, one of the things I've discovered since taking the job at also is that I've never worked in a quiet environment before. And even at Melbourne Festival, it was not really a particularly quiet environment. Mm-hmm. There were so many people and things going on. And if I have to make it busy in order for me to be most effective, maybe
it's
that's
a bit
what
quiet
happen.
Downstairs, is it?
Well, it has to be on some levels because it's still in the sort of infancy and of really starting of being in that building, and it's we need to start getting sort of people coming in more often.
It's a bit late in our conversation today because we're heading for the news at 12 to ask this question. But do you think
this has been another Joy 94.9 podcast? Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.